Great, we'll turn back, if you could, to the book of Esther. And we're going to be looking at this chapter together this morning. We're looking this morning at the beginning to look at this book, the book of Esther. And I've given it the title, in some ways, for the whole book, the drama of Esther. The Jews, you might know, had their feasts. They had Passover, they had the Feast of Tabernacles. We had the Harvest Feast, Pentecost, and they came to add one more to that list of festivals, and that was the Feast of Purim, and it's talked about in the book of Esther in chapter 9 and 10, and so on. And the Feast of Purim was a very jolly celebration. It was one of feasting and eating and enjoying food and drink together. It would be one of family gatherings. And there was present giving. You'll find some of the details in chapter 9. And the drama of Esther was kind of there to give a reason for the season. Like we'd say sometimes at Christmas, where we see people's feasting and their excitement and how happy everyone can be. And we want to enjoy that, yes, but we want to show people there's a reason for it. And that's what the book of Esther is doing about their Feast of Purim. It's trying to give a reason for that season. And so the chapter that we have before us, chapter 1, is there to set the scene. And the drama of Esther is a historical one. It's a historical account. And it fits here in the Bible, in this place. And although it doesn't make a lot of references to other parts of the Bible, it does fit there in the story of God's people, and it fits in what we know of other parts of world history. For those of you who like timelines, here's a few details. Things that have happened before it was the rise of the Babylonian Empire under Nebuchadnezzar, and then came the fall of Jerusalem. Well, there were three groups that went off into exile until Jerusalem was finally demolished, the walls of the temple were broken down and the like. And all of that's given in 2 Kings and Chronicles and in the prophets like Jeremiah as well. And they'd then been in exile for about 70 years. Other kings had come and gone. Belshazzar is one of the more famous ones. And you have the accounts in Ezekiel and Daniel about the things that happened during those times. And then the empire of the Babylonians was taken over by the empire of the Persians and the Medes. They're referred to quite a few times in our chapter we just read. And the first of their kings was Cyrus. And under Cyrus, the Israelites made a first return from exile under a leader called Zerubbabel. And that's given to us in the first half of the book of Ezra. And then after that came other kings like Darius, other prophets like Haggai and Zechariah. And then came the king who's rather confusingly got three names. And that's Ahasuerus, who's here in Esther chapter 1. And that's his Hebrew name that the Jews knew him as. He was also known as King Xerxes, who have NIVs or more modern translations will often use that word. He was also known as Artaxerxes, which is confusing because there was another one of those. So we call him Artaxerxes the First. And that's all in the book of Esther. After this, the next little bit of history that comes next is that one, the Artaxerxes the Second. And then the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, or the second half of Ezra, tell us about a second return from exile under Ezra, then a third return under Nehemiah when they started rebuilding the temple and rebuilding the walls and the like. And prophets like Malachi who come right at the end. So that's just helping you get your bearings on where the book of Esther fits. And it fits, to say, a little bit strangely in between the returns from exile. The large group have gone already under Zerubbabel, but there's a delay. Some would go later under Ezra and Nehemiah. And while that's taking place in the reign of Ahasuerus, the book of Esther fits. And so it is this historical account of those things that happened. What happened to these Jews living there in Babylon that had then become Persia? What happened to these Jews who stayed behind? But although it is a historical account, it's also an entertaining drama. And that's why I've called it the drama of Esther, because Esther doesn't tell us history like you would find in Chronicles or Kings. They're very matter of fact. They're giving you a neat historical account. But Esther's much more than that. It's there to engage us emotionally. It's more than just a historical account. It'd be more like the difference of something that, say, is happening today, and journalists write an article about it, some government official writes a paper about it, and then somebody writes a film about it. And the film could be a true account, but it's going to do it in a very different way to that rather boring government report or that very matter-of-fact article in the newspaper. And Esther's a bit like that. It's almost sort of the film version of something. It's there to try and move us and involve us in it. It may well have been actually over the time that followed, just as we have our nativity plays at the festival of Christmas to give a reason for the season. It may well have been that the Jews had Esther plays that were performed to give a reason for the season at the Feast of Purim. And it may have been that people acted out this kind of book each year at their festivals as well. And so, firstly, setting the scene. We're meant to be amazed at the world's greatness here. Here, this is the world's greatest empire. We're told in verse 1 of this King Ahasuerus, who reigns over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. This was one of the greatest kingdoms there ever was in the history of the world. In some ways, the kingdom of the Romans, the empire of the Romans, was bigger, but the kingdom of Persia was the richest by far. It was the greatest of world empires. We're going to see that in some of the things that are described later on. There are these 127 provinces stretching all the way from India to Ethiopia. The capital, we're told, was in Shushan, or other versions of the Bible will call it Susa. Same place. Most people think they know where it is, on a plain in Iran. And there they built these capital cities, but they thought a plain was too flat and boring for such an empire, so they employed thousands of slaves to build hills to then build the city on top of, because it would look much more impressive if that was the case. And this vast empire, we're told here in the Bible that it came in the third year of his reign, verse 3, that King Ahasuerus made this great feast. And what a feast it was. Did you notice how long it lasted for? We're told it twice. It lasted for 180 days. That's 6 months of that third year of his reign. He spent half the year feasting. Half the year, in all likelihood, all the people that are described coming there in verse 3, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles, the princes who come, probably came and went at assigned times during this. Otherwise, the entire empire would have collapsed had no one done any work for 6 months and just feasted. And so, in all likelihood, people came and went as it happened. And yet, still, for 6 months of the year, this seems to have been the case. For those of you who know some little bit of other secular history, it may also have been a planning phase for the rather ill-fated Battle of Salamis that happened sometime afterwards. But it may have been a military conference attached to it as well. But it seems they're doing an awful lot more feasting than they are doing planning, which may account for the reason their invasion later on failed. But then, at the end, at the climax of this 180-day banquet, is another 7-day banquet. And so we're told in verse 5 that when those days were completed, so they weren't satisfied with 180 days of feasting, the king was going to make another feast lasting another 7 days. But this time it's slightly different. It's for all the people who were present in Shushan, the citadel, from great to small. And so for the climax of this 6-month feast is a 1-week feast for everyone who lives in the capital. And it happens in a vast garden of the palace. And so there is this party at the palace. And what a party it is. There in these verses it describes for us, verse 6, the blue and white linen curtains fastened with corns of linen and purple, silver rods, marble pillars, couches of gold and silver, on a mosaic pavement of alabaster, turquoise, white and black marble, and they serve drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other. What a party this was. The world had never seen anything like this. And we've never seen anything like it either, have we? Imagine being there at this palace. It's described in such ways, you know, the sort of the seven wonders of the ancient world and the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. It's sort of read in a similar way to that, isn't it? This garden here in Shushan in Persia. And this great party that there was. Overhead, these curtains keeping everyone nicely in the shade. The guests reclining on couches of silver and gold. Everyone's being drunk, given drinks in golden cups. And each cup is handmade. No mass-produced stuff from IKEA. No, every single one is handcrafted. And there they are, enjoying all of the things that are there provided for them. How are we meant to respond to this? Well, we're meant to respond with amazement. Amazement at the sheer greatness of this empire. Such wealth that we can't possibly imagine. It's a little bit like those programs that sort of invite you to see how the other half live. Who lives in a house like this? You know, those sort of programs that take you around somebody's house and you go up to this mansion along this huge long drive with fountains at the front and the like, and you go inside this mansion and you see all of these extravagant things, the paintings on the wall like a stately home, or whether it's the vast treasures and all the gadgets around, the homes of the rich and famous, their massive swimming pools, their garages full of collectible cars. And we're having a little peek like that. A little bit like sort of flicking through, not that I often do, the celebrity magazines. And seeing about one celebrity wedding. Or what are the royals up to now? What car are they driving? What's going on? And that's a little bit of what it's like here. We're having a peek behind the scenes at how the other half live. And the sheer greatness. We're meant to be in awe of this kind of thing that we have described. It's described in such exquisite detail for us, isn't it? To move us, to just our draw to drop down and thinking, wow, what a sight this would have been. But at the same time, we're meant to be revolted at the world's wickedness. It's a funny thing, this scene that's set before us. It is one of such extravagance and greatness. But there's sort of undercurrents as well the whole way through it that actually, whereas our jaw drops down in amazement at such riches and power, we also feel a bit like being sick because this is just so over the top. We're meant to be somewhat revolted at this king's pretentiousness and pride. Did you notice his little speech? In verse 4, when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days. Get a load of this guy. What a fantastic palace he's got, yes, but I think his ego's bigger. He says, come everyone and look at this. My riches of his glorious kingdom. The splendor of my excellent majesty. How many words do you need to add in a speech like that? See the pride, the ego of this man. We might want to ask as well, where did it all come from? Yes, here's this vast palace and this great sixth-month banquet. Who was paying for it? It was paid by the taxes of his subjugated people, wasn't it? It told us that he was ruler over 127 provinces. That's 127 countries he'd conquered. 127 different people groups who were enslaved to him. That's where it all came from. That's where all this money came from. The exploitation of others. It actually wasn't even anything Ahasuerus had done himself. It was mostly what they'd inherited from the Babylonians. His king, his father and his grandfather, Cyrus and Darius, had been those who had gone to great lengths to extend their empire. Ahasuerus did very little apart from lose. He was standing on the backs of giants. All this extravagance he was showing off was what other people had won for him. And there it was. And through his conquering exploitation of others, that's where this extravagance came from. And we're told of this six-month beast and the seven-day feast that came after it. We're told in verse 10 that after the seventh day, that's after the previous 6 months, that the heart of the king was merry with wine. That's an understatement. He's been on a drinking binge for 187 days now. And all the other things you're not told with that, all the little stories that over the course of this 6 month and then 1 week feast, all the drunkenness and greed and overindulgence, what damage had that done? What damage had that done to marriages? What damages had that done to people's self-control? All the stories that would be reported in the tabloid newspapers as that went along. There's overtones too in verse 9. Queen Vashti made a feast for the women in the royal palace, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. It seems that it was a separate sort of thing. The king was having his feast. The queen and the harem of the king were kept separate. And in overtones of things that will happen later, they were all there. They're having their own feast, but it's nothing to compare with the feast that's happening outside. You could imply from that perhaps this is a feast for the men. And the women aren't there. Because the men don't know what... The men don't want to know. They don't want to see their wives knowing what they've got up to at it. And just in all these different things, just the daftness of it all. We're meant to be revolted at it. We'll come back to that a little bit more later on. And some of it too is just the silliness of it all. So we're revolted at the world's wickedness, but we're rather amused sometimes at the world's silliness. One of the silly things is in verse 8. In accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory. Whoever thought it necessary to pass a law that drinking wasn't compulsory? Well, here they did. They love that sort of stuff, making daft laws, making one legislation for another, even a legislation to say there's no legislation necessary for the topic of drinking. In fact, the king ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. So if he wanted a pint of lager, he was not going to be force-fed port. If he wanted something, he wasn't going to be forced to drink red wine if he really preferred champagne. What an unnecessary law to pass. We're meant to sometimes read some of these things in an account like this and have a sort of little snigger to ourselves that, what's going on here? Is this really necessary to be like that? If we look at a chapter like here in the book of Esther, we're meant to be amazed and disgusted sometimes at the things we see. Well, back to the drama in chapter 1. On the seventh day, we're told, the climactic day of a climactic week after a six-month festival, out goes the instruction, bring out the queen! In another typical over-the-top sort of way, verse 10, the king commanded seven servants to go and get the queen. And the queen was summoned to appear before the king and all his officials, were told in verse 11, wearing her royal crown. The Jews believe that's only her royal crown and nothing else, which may be or maybe not. But either way, it was obvious for the little aside that comes later on, for she was beautiful to behold, and he wants to show her beauty. So, regardless of exactly how much she was wearing when she was meant to be doing that, it is for the purpose of the king bringing her out, his trophy wife, for everyone to ogle and leer at. And all this build-up comes along. We've got 6 months, we've had the empire described, the feast described, this week described, and then out goes the command to bring out the queen. All this build-up, the riches of the glorious kingdom, the splendour of his excellent majesty, and the king wants to bring out his best, his trophy wife, to show off. And they knock at the queen's door, and she says no. And we're meant to snigger at this point. Here's this king, one of the greatest emperors there has ever been. And they knock at the queen's door, and she says, no, I'm not. Can you imagine these 7 eunuchs standing at the door, what they said next? What do you mean, your majesty? No. Oh, you can't say no. And she just says, no. And can you imagine the 7 eunuchs looking at each other, right, saying, right, you tell him. You go back, you tell him, no, you tell him. And the like, one of them draws the short straw and goes back to tell the king that the queen said no. And the emperor goes ballistic. There it is in verse 12. Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command brought by the eunuchs. Therefore the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. This powerful emperor goes ballistic. A little bit of snide sarcasm implied a little bit at this kind of point as well. He brings out all the wise men, verse 13. He brings out the king's 7 princes, verse 14. The entire civil service is brought to bear in this most pressing issue facing the empire. For there is the typical over-the-topness of it all. A marital argument that is now rocking the empire. And so, the whole civil service, the wise men of verse 13, the princes of verse 14, are brought before the king, before this emperor. And the item on the agenda is, verse 15, what shall we do to Queen Vashti? The king summons his cabinet and brings before them one question. What should I say to my wife? That's the question. What should I say to my wife? And the civil service are all assembled there, ready to do the king's bidding. All because a husband made a drunken demand of his wife, and his wife dared to say no. And now, this brilliant facade we have had built up for us through chapter 1, a crack comes straight through it. The might of the empire. What is it going to do about a wife who says no? What am I going to say to my wife? Verse 15. And we're meant to sort of snigger to ourselves. What an idiot. What an idiot he is. What does the law say should be done to Queen Vashti? Well, duh, nothing. Laws, of course, don't have anything to do with that. We're meant to laugh at such thing. If any of you have ever watched Yes Minister, it's that kind of comedy sketch that we have played out for us here. Not sort of rib-tickling comedy, but one of sarcasm and satire. If any of you watched Yes Minister, it's Sir Humphrey, who then takes centre stage. Well, here he's called McCunan. And he's this side of civil servant who pops up with his bombling, waffling, pompous speech about this is the end of the world, this is the thin end of the wedge. This royal marital problem is going to threaten the integrity of the entire nation. And so he begins in verse 16. McCunan answered before the king and the princes, Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also all the princes, all the people in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. Blowing it out of all proportion, the queen has wronged the king, the princes, and all the people in 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. The queen has wronged every single one of them by what she's done. She's set a dangerous precedent. He carries on in verse 17, for the queen's behaviour will become known to all women, and they'll despise their husbands in their eyes when they report that King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to come, and she did not come. This very day, the noble ladies of Persia will say to all the king's officials that they've heard of the behaviour of the queen, and there will be excessive contempt and wrath. Yeah, we're meant to sort of smile a little bit at this rather pompous speech that is blowing everything out of all proportion. The queen has set a dangerous precedent. All the women in the empire are going to follow suit. And when other drunken husbands make dramatic requests of their wives, other wives might dare to say no as well. What on earth? The institution of marriage is under threat. There's going to be despising, excessive contempt, and wrath. All the noble ladies of Persia and Media, verse 18, are going to go off the rails. Every marriage in the empire is doomed to fall apart because of a marital spat between Ahasuerus and Vashti. The whole of society is doomed. And that's his speech. So, great waffling speech, but what are we going to do, was the original question, which he hasn't answered so far. But he says then in verse 18, if it pleases the king, all right, let a royal decree go out from him, all right, and it should be one of the laws of the Persians and Medes, all right, and it will never be altered, all right, but what is it? What are we going to do in this situation? This is the law, middle of verse 19, that Vashti shall come no more between King Ahasuerus. This great waffling, pompous speech leads to its climax. The law we should pass is this, that Queen Vashti should not have to appear before King Ahasuerus. The very thing she didn't want to do anyway. The one thing she'd done anyway off her own bat. She didn't want to appear before the king. And so now we're going to pass a royal law that the queen cannot appear before the king. And in fact, we'll get rid of the queen and get a better one. Here's how it finishes in verse 19. And we'll send out this decree. It goes on, verse 20. We'll send out this law through the whole empire so that everyone will know. Verse 20, the king's decree which he will make will be proclaimed through all of his empire, which is great, and all wives will honour their husbands, both great and small. Which, of course, is publicising the very thing he didn't want people to know before, in the verses before. Of course, no one throughout the whole empire knew of this. At the moment, this has only happened in the capital city, amongst the people who are there. He blows it up into all proportion and says everyone in the entire 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia know about it already, which they probably didn't. And so we're going to make a law to publicise the king's marital problems and tell everyone not to do the same thing. And so after this bumbling, pontificating speech, it needs to be turned into a law. And it carries on, verse 21. The reply pleased the king and the princes, and the king did according to the word of Makubin. So he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province in his own script, and to every people in their own language, that what? This king's verdict now has to be wheeled out through the bureaucratic wheels, through the red tape system, and out goes the law that's going to go out to every single household in the entire empire of Persia and Media. And what is the law? That each man should be master of his own house and speak in the language of his own people. So there you have another stupid, unnecessary, unenforceable law. We're going to tell everyone in the entire empire that the husband should be the head of the family, which every single culture the Persians had invaded did already. And how would they ever enforce it anyway? They couldn't. As for the last bit, about that everyone should speak the language of his own people, well, duh, that's what they do anyway. What does it even mean? What does it have anything to do with the situation here anyway? Well, it's just the typical ridiculous nonsense. Here through the second half of the chapter, it is watching the king swing a sledgehammer to crack a nut, and he misses, and he makes a big hole in his nicely marble alabaster floor. That's all watching through this chapter. Well, what do we learn from a chapter like this? Part of it is to set the scene, so that all the things that happen later on in the book of Esther can fit. Yes, it's a little bit like a drama, so the first act, chapter one, has got to try and set the stage for us, so we understand where all the things that are going to happen later on in this book happen, the kind of situation it's taking place in. But here in this chapter, what are a couple of little things that we can apply to ourselves? Firstly, don't take the world too seriously. Don't take the world too seriously. The world likes to dramatise things in the typical yes minister way. Oh, this is the end of the world, this is the thin end of the wedge, this is the end of civilization as we know it. People love to dramatise things and blow things out of all proportion. The world loves its pomp and ceremony, perhaps not to quite the same extent as King Ahasuerus, but still the celebrities, the politicians, the royals love their pomp and ceremony. But sometimes, perhaps, if you imagine, say, the Book of Esther being played out a little bit like an Esther-style nativity play, it'd be quite comical to watch the scene of chapter one being played out by some children, wouldn't it? And children love to dress up. They can do some tomorrow at Mums and Tots. And you can imagine just a one little three-year-old boy put on a crown and he says, oh, I'm going to marry you. And there's this two-year-old girl and she puts on a crown and a little pretty dress and the like. And imagine a couple of kids acting out this scene. Because it's that kind of thing that's going on here. It's like children playing kings and queens. And sometimes we see those things in the world, don't we? There's a chap called Donald, somewhere on the west. And there's a chap called Kim, who lives somewhere on the east. And did you hear their bantering a few months ago? I've got more nuclear missiles than you. I can obliterate the world twice, and I can obliterate the world 10 times, so I've got a bigger button than yours. And I say, hey, Donald, Kim, stop behaving like kids. Calm down. You're making these things too dramatic. You're getting all worked up about your own status in these things. Sometimes we see the same in our own country in Prime Minister's Question Times. I can never watch that programme because I've heard better on the school playgrounds. It's just cheering and bantering at each other. Sometimes we need not to take the world too seriously. It's good to laugh. And strangely, God does it too. In chapter 2, in Psalm 2, we read of God laughing as all the kings of this world and all the people take their stand against God. God laughs. And here it is in Esther chapter 1. We're meant to laugh. We're meant to laugh because we know it's not been said and it won't ever actually be said in Esther. But the undercurrent the whole way through is that God is in control. Yes, we've been painted this dramatic picture in the first half of chapter 1 that here's King Ahasuerus. He's the one sitting on the throne. He's the one who's in control. Yeah, right. He can't even get his wife to open the door. He's in control of nothing. We laugh at such pompous arrogance. And we know that God is in control. Don't take the world too seriously. Sometimes laugh at its silliness, because we know the real king who's in control. Secondly, I'm rather reminded of the verses that the words that Jesus said, "What profits a man if he gains the whole world?" Here's that man. Ahasuerus is ruler over almost the entire known world at this time. Ahasuerus is the man who's gained the world. 127 provinces of it. He has it all. He has golden couches. He has palaces. He has capital cities. He has all of these people around him. He has a vast civil service who come to his aid because he's had an argument with his wife. He's the man who has it all. And yet we laugh at him because he's got nothing. He's got nothing. He doesn't even have the respect of his own wife. And so the Bible tells us, Jesus tells us, don't envy the rich, doesn't he? You read these bits of Esther, it sounds like one of those descriptions of a house. You know when you're looking up houses on Rightmove, or you go to the estate agent, and the way it describes houses, oh, you need to move to a house like this, and it describes all the exquisite detail or whatever it is, especially posh ones, you know what I mean. But when we sometimes read those kind of things and think, oh, if only I had something like this, perhaps not a palace like this, but even on a little scale, we envy the rich. We want a little bit more. We covet. We're greedy too in our own little ways. But don't do it. Look at the man who has it all and who has nothing. Don't envy the rich. Don't envy the royals. Don't envy the celebrities. We're given that command for a reason. Do not covet. And lastly, look at this king. Look at this king that's portrayed for us in chapter 1. He's powerful. He's wealthy. He's ruler over a vast empire. He has a vast army at his beck and call. He has all sorts of snivelling civil servants who just live to butter him up and inflate his ego for him. But he's a drunk. He's bad-tempered. He's cruel. He's exploiting. He's self-glorifying. Look at this king. And we know who the true king is. We have Jesus. The king who sits enthroned in far greater splendor than Ahasuerus ever did. But what a different king he is. He's the servant king. The king who came to give his life. The king who did not come to be served, but to serve others. And in Jesus we see the exact opposite, don't we, of Ahasuerus. A king who's self-controlled and humble and patient and kind and loving. Who would you rather have as your king? Would you like to be one of these princes, one of these civil servants? As they go pandering around to this emperor's knees, who would you rather follow? Who would you have as your king? Who would you rather put your faith in? And who would you rather be like? For we have a far greater king, King Jesus. Let's close and sing in our last hymn about that. It's number 310, if you want to follow it in the hymn books, that talks about our King, King Jesus, the one who reigns, the one who reigns over all the world. Let's sing, stand and sing, "Jesus shall reign where'er the sun."